Cash started writing songs while at Landsberg. Ben Perea remembers him writing "Hey Porter" and that the military paper Stars and Stripes published the words. He wrote "Belshazzar," his earliest gospel song, while there, and Orville Rigdon asserts that he started writing "Don't Take Your Guns to Town" at the barracks. Certainly the song's protagonist, Billy Joe, was named after Billy Joe Carnahan. Also while in Germany, Cash saw Crane Wilbur's 1951 film Inside the Walls of Folsom Prison, which inspired him to begin writing almost immediately. He liked that film quite a bit, remembers Ben Perea. It was shown in the recreation hall on the base, and he wanted it to be shown again. Cash also claimed that the musical inspiration for "I Walk the Line" came when someone inadvertently twisted a rehearsal tape in the Wilcox Gay tape recorder that he'd bought from the base PX. When he hit play, it sounded like religious music, but what he was actually hearing were backward chords. "The drone and those weird chord changes stayed with me," he said. In 1956, he added the words. The first time they heard themselves on tape was when Paul E. Smith arrived in January 1953 and spent 8 weeks with Cash as his Morse code instructor. Smith had a reel-to-reel recorder that he had had sent to him by Allied Radio in Chicago, and he joined the boys in the basement to tape their efforts. "They would pick and sing, and John would write little ditties and songs, and so I would record these," he says. "Later I was shipped to Scotland, and I sold the recorder to a GI in Kirknewton, and I let the tapes go with it." "When we were playing in Germany, I knew there was something special about John," says Carnahan. "He was kind of a charismatic character. He was always telling stories. He had the wildest imagination you ever came across in your entire life. It was a very wild imagination. He also seemed to have this uncanny ability to know which way things were going to develop in the future. He was able to anticipate trends." Besides telling stories, Cash was writing stories. He told a friend that he had published some under the pen name Johnny Dollar, a popular radio detective, either in a magazine for men or in a literary journal. One of his stories from 1953, a science fiction piece titled "The Holographic Dancer," was kept in his drawer until 2001, when his daughter Roseanne published it as part of the collection Songs Without Rhyme, Prose by Celebrated Songwriters. For a 21-year-old Arkansas farm boy who had never taken a course in literature, "The Holographic Dancer" was an imaginative piece of writing. It portrayed a 21st-century America that had been conquered by Russia. Major cities had been razed by nuclear attacks, and entertainment was paid for in kiosks and then piped into homes via phone lines. Partly inspired by the news of the explosion in television broadcasting, he envisaged a time when live holographic entertainment would be beamed into living rooms for $12 a show. He further imagined the possibility of a man projecting himself into the hologram. The story illustrates his growing preoccupation with words. "One of the first things the Soviets did," he wrote in his story, "was to desecrate the English language. In order to speed up integration, the niceties of grammar and spelling were forsaken, and everyone wrote words phonetically. His friends at Landsberg remember his fascination with unusual words and new coinages." Jack Matheson has never forgotten Cash informing him that the longest word in the English language was anti-disestablishmentarianism. With Chuck Riley, he used to pass time during breaks by organizing word-making competitions. "We each had to make up a word which would stump the other," he says. "John would always beat me. I remember one time he came up with cremate a rat-latax. I gave up and asked him what it meant. He said that it was the art of burning rat tails. Latax was Latin for the tail of an animal. Cremate was to burn, and then there was the rat, obviously." Cash also liked to draw. Bob Moody recalls that he loved the cartoons of Rube Goldberg and often made sketches of mechanical devices. Well remembered by those who lived in the Landsberg barracks, Cash's drawing of a saguaro cactus surrounded by sand and bleached bones hung framed on the wall beside his bed. He titled it "Custer's Last Stand." A closer look at the drawing revealed a hidden genius, a thinly disguised finger raised as a symbol of insult. "It was giving the bird," says Jack Matheson. "The guy was a total talent." One of the great advantages of serving with the 12th RSM in Germany was the 3-day break that followed every 6 days on duty. Men could take their passes and travel to major European cities. If transport was available, they could even save money by hitching rides on military aircraft. For the more hedonistically inclined, this presented a grand opportunity to sample the beer and brothels of places like Amsterdam and Copenhagen. The sporting types look forward to skiing in the Austrian Alps or swimming on the French Riviera. To Cash, these breaks brought the chance to follow country pursuits, such as trout fishing at Gross Kietzschkoffen, or exploring the art and architecture of major cultural centers. As Rich Collins observes, it was a great opportunity for those of us who were young and who had seen nothing more than our local towns to go to Europe and see this remarkable variety of cultures. For most of us, it was a tremendously opening experience. Cash most preferred traveling with Ted Freeman and Ben Perea. The red-headed Freeman grew up on a farm in Nicholas County, West Virginia, and Cash nicknamed him Finrod, both in honor of his given name, Fenton, and the eponymous 12-year-old hero of Booth Tarkington's novel, Penrod. They took the train down to Venice, where they played together in a sidewalk cafe, and to Oberammergau, where the renowned Passion Play is produced once every decade. The last production had been in 1950, when General Eisenhower had attended a show. With Perea, Cash went to Zurich, London, where they saw the newly crowned Queen Elizabeth arriving for the premiere of the film The Conquest of Everest at a cinema near Piccadilly Circus, Munich, Salzburg, Amsterdam, and Berlin. What struck Perea was the way in which Cash would become quietly absorbed in all he saw. In Holland, the sight of the old windmills with their huge wooden sails transfixed him. He looked at them, and once he saw something he really liked, he would stop. He would gaze at it and just stand there thinking, "I'd just stay beside him until he was done." That's the way he was. When they went to Paris in October 1953, Cash wanted to drink in everything. He wanted to see the Sorbonne. He wanted to see Notre Dame. He wanted to visit the Louvre and see the Mona Lisa. Oh, how he wanted to see that. We saw the Pigalle district and the Arc de Triomphe. We did a lot of walking in Paris. He wanted to walk and to see. He didn't really like organized tours. He wanted to walk and see, to look at everything. He actually wanted to touch the things, to see and to touch. Cash's jottings made on the trip reveal how little sophistication he had at the time. A country kid who grew up surrounded by flat, dark earth, cotton, and single-story white buildings now stood before some of civilization's greatest artistic and cultural achievements. He had no points of comparison, no vocabulary adequate enough to analyze his responses. It was all so awe-inspiring. Upon first impression, October 18, 1953, Cash found Paris a poor, dirty place, but after cleaning up back at the hotel and putting on civvies, he found it didn't look so bad. He saw the Arc de Triomphe. It was really a beautiful thing, about three times as big as I thought it would be and a lot prettier. We walked around there taking pictures and then went on to the Eiffel Tower. That was something else. That was different than I'd imagined. It didn't seem so high, but was probably higher than it looked. We couldn't see it from very far off because of the fog, and we didn't go to the top because we were plenty cold on the ground where we were, and it sure looked a lot colder up there. Privately, Cash began to focus on the idea of making music his career, a bold step for an unskilled instrumentalist who could count on his fingers the total number of his public performances, including those at school. Based on sheer musical ability, the best bets in Landsberg would have been on Ted Freeman and Bill Carnahan, both of whom possessed skill and versatility. Cash's primitive playing style and limited voice range still needed a lot of work. "I thought he had great potential as a performer," says Orville Rigdon. "I just didn't care much for his singing ability. His voice wavered and was unstable. His forte was his charisma and his ability to write. He was never an accomplished guitar player, but he did have a knack for writing story-type songs." Though Cash's religion and upbringing may have contributed to his restraint from any wild passions he might have had during his tour of duty, an even more significant influence keeping him on the straight and narrow was Vivian Liberto. Everyone who knew Cash knew about Vivian. He had her picture in his locker, talked about her to anyone who was willing to listen, and wrote to her every single day. For example, between May 2nd through the 18th, 1952, he posted a total of 12 letters. On May 9th alone, he posted 3. Cash thought he was in love with Vivian, and she thought she was in love with him. He wanted her to come to Germany and marry him, and proposed to her through the post. He even rented a hard-to-come-by apartment in Landsberg for her, but Vivian's father wouldn't entertain the idea. He wasn't going to let his precious daughter go off to Europe to marry a man she'd only dated for 30 days. When he realized that she wouldn't be coming, Cash passed the apartment on to Bill Carnahan, who was himself newly married. Cash's utter faithfulness to this girl he barely knew astonished most of his colleagues, who thought that military service was synonymous with excess and wild oats. Some of them felt that his devotion to Vivian contributed to his feeling of restlessness. He was in love, says Rich Collins. He saw faithfulness to her as a big factor in his life. If you put together his music, his love of socializing in small groups back at the barracks rather than drinking and picking up girls, and his loyalty to this woman, you can see why he probably didn't see the military as opportunity-making as a lot of us did. He was marking time until he could come back home and marry. Cash flew back to America from Germany and went to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, where he received his honorable discharge on July 3, 1954. This was the same day that a guitarist in Memphis, Scotty Moore, called a hopeful young singer, Elvis Aaron Presley, and invited him to audition for Sam Phillips at Sun Records. Musical revolution was in the air.